Welcome to this oral history presentation of The Black 14. This interview is with Judge James Barrett, who was then Attorney General for the state of Wyoming in 1969 during the Black 14 incident. This podcast is produced by the Wyoming State Archives by Sue Castaneda. The interviewer is Wyoming historian Mark Youngie. It was funded by the Wyoming Cultural Trust Fund.
Today is the 8th of July, 2010, and my name is Mark Youngie, and I'm in the home of Judge James E. Barrett, who was formerly the U.S. District Court of Appeals, 10th Circuit Court judge in Wyoming for the 10th Circuit Court, correct?
Right, correct.
Okay, and I'm here at his home at 626 Manor Lane in Western Hills in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and today, it's a beautiful, gorgeous day out there today. So I thought what we could do, if you don't mind, is talk a little bit about your life, how you were raised, and maybe get some of your thoughts down on tape about your father and mother, about your education and going to law school, about your service in the Army, and your service as a judge, your public career, and then talk also about the Black 14.
All right.
Okay, and just for the transcriber's purpose here, the judge has written an article about the Black 14 that was that appeared in the Annals of Wyoming Historical Magazine some years back. Let's talk about the Black 14.
Okay.
Okay, and I read your article, and I've read a whole bunch of other stuff on it. I still need to read a lot more. What is your overall perception of this whole incident in the scheme of history? How do you look at this, Judge?
Well, I'm more sympathetic with Eaton than many people are. I found him to be completely sincere, honest, and forthright, intelligent, but maybe not very diplomatic. He was a strict disciplinarian. He believed that members of his football team should not participate in any kinds of protests of any kind. He had a rule that forbade that, and of course that rule would run up against the Constitution in terms of certain protests. But in this particular case, he applied it properly, I thought, and told them so. And that is that religion or protests against any religion or church had no place in a football scene. And they couldn't use a football field to protest somebody's religion. He didn't arrive at that by reason of reading any law or cases and so on. But that was his line of thinking, and he told them that, too.
Didn't he revise that rule a little bit right after the incident?
He was told he had to, and he did have to. Tinker versus Des Moines school districts, which said that grade school kids could wear armbands, protest the Vietnam War, you know, had come down the same year as this happened, 1969.
Now, how aware of were you of this and Stan Hathaway of this Tinker versus Des Moines school district?
Oh, I was fully aware of it. So was Stan Hathaway. But we differentiated that from applying the facts of the case. We came to different conclusions. In the case of the Black 14, the protest was against the beliefs of the Mormon Church, and they wanted to wear the armbands during the football game. They insisted on it. The position of the state was, including Hathaway, four lawyers on the Board of Trustees, was that the university, being an agency of the state of Wyoming, could not permit any of its agents to use the football field to protest somebody's religious beliefs, no matter how racial they believed it to be. The state could not permit them to do that. That's the position that we took.
Now, you say you differed from Hathaway, or you
don't? No, we saw it the same way. Hathaway wasn't as acquainted with Tinker versus Des Moines as I was, but a couple members of the Board of Trustees were.
Who were the lawyers on the Board of Trustees?
Al Pence was one from Laramie.
Right.
Bill Jones from Wheatland. Eef Johnson from Rawlins.
Eef?
Eef. E-P-H. Eef Johnson.
Okay.
Mike Sullivan's father from Douglas.
Joe Sullivan?
Joe Sullivan. Although I didn't have contact with Joe, he didn't particularly, but Al Pence was pretty much the leader. And he was well acquainted with
the Tinker
prohibition
decision
against
So were they in concert? Did they agree in concert, or was there a split of opinion?
No, they all agreed.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they all agreed.
Oh, I thought you said there was a difference of opinion.
No.
Oh, okay.
No, they all agreed. When they were convinced that the 14 were insisting on wearing the armbands during the game, that was conclusive then when they realized that they couldn't talk them out of that. Then they had to back the coach up at that point.
Well, I understand that, let's see, now Joe Giraud, wasn't he the president's lawyer or counsel, President Carlson's counsel?
Joe Giraud was representing the university, but he didn't get involved in this, in the Black 14.
Oh, he didn't?
No.
Well, what was Carlson's opinion of this?
Carlson accepted Hathaway and Pence's position. I don't personally believe that he was very solid on it. I think he had his misgivings.
Where were you when you first heard about the armband incident?
I got a call from the Governor Hathaway about 7:30 or 8 o'clock on the morning of the game, which I think was the 18th.
The game was the 18th, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he told me, he gave me a rundown of what happened. When he mentioned what they intended to protest, my first reaction was, well, the state can't permit them to use the playing field to do that.
Oh, you weren't advising him all along? You found out about this the day of the game.
No, I wasn't brought into it till after the decision was made.
Why not? You were the attorney general.
Well, I don't think that anybody... Well, a snowstorm had occurred that day, and it was really a blizzard. By the time that Stan got over there and so on, it would have been impossible for me to get there. So that's why I wasn't able to be at the meeting.
Did you get the chance to meet William Waterman and Charles Graves and
yes.
Smythe and what was the other?
Wes Reeves.
Reeves, yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you meet with those guys in your office?
They came to my office just before the lawsuit was filed. That's the only time I met with them.
What was their purpose?
Their purpose was to tell me that this was the last chance for the state to remedy the wrong before they filed the lawsuit. They were so cocky about their position, legally. They were sure that Tinker versus Des Moines controlled everything, and I knew that it didn't. Well, anyway, they gave me this was the last chance, and the command was that the football coach abolish his rule. He'd already done that. They be restored to the football team without condition, that they be allowed to wear the armbands in any manner they wish at any time, and that the head coach be fired. So I told them, well, I said, I don't even have to contact my clients to tell you. I represented all of them. I said, your demands are not acceptable. So later that afternoon, Waterman and the attorneys filed the lawsuit in the federal district court here. That's how it got started.
Well, which demand was the most offensive to you?
Well, I think probably the most offensive one was their demand that the coach be fired.
Yeah, that's like in Wyoming, at that time, with Floyd Eaton as popular as he was, it seems like that would have been tantamount to deleting one letter from the English language.
That's right.
Or the alphabet.
The worst part of it is that they all agreed he was a great coach.
Well, I thought that Williams tried to talk to him, but there was something here. It said, you talked about some evidentiary rules that prohibited Barrett, you, from asking Williams if he had refused to meet with Coach Eaton and Judge Kerr that day to discuss settlement of the lawsuit.
That's right.
And I'm a little confused about that whole procedure. Why was it evidentially unsound or illegal?
Well, because you can't introduce into evidence any terms of a proposed settlement. If it didn't take effect, it's privileged communication. So unless they brought it up, I couldn't mention it.
Was Williams even aware of this proposed settlement?
Well, I don't think so, because I know that he wasn't, because this is entirely a separate thing, but I think I told you what, I think the article says what Waterman said to me when I asked him about the meeting. He said that there'll be no such meetings. That was all there was. I assumed that he had talked to the Black 14 about it. I didn't know, but I assumed he would. He would have talked to his clients about a meeting. It turns out that he hadn't, because I found out later, I called those players. This is off the record here, because it was not brought into the loss. I called them and talked to them and found out not a single one of them had any recollection about a proposed meeting. Not a single one of them.
Can I assume that you feel Waterman had his own personal agenda?
And this yes. Yes, he did. He was going to make civil rights history. He was going to make civil rights history.
So he, in effect, did not care about his clients enough to allow them to discuss it and come to a settlement.
That's my feeling. That's my feeling.
Is your take on it then, Judge, the idea that if Waterman had said to his clients, look, you guys, we can settle this, that it would have been taken care of?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I know it would have been.
Okay, but what on the other hand, I look at why couldn't have Judge Kerr have issued a temporary restraining order to let this process go a little bit more?
You mean issue it on behalf of the 14?
Yeah, see, somebody was asking for a restraining order.
The 14, the plaintiffs were the plaintiffs, the 14.
Yeah, why wouldn't Judge Kerr be in a mood to grant that till this could get worked out?
Well, if he granted it, he would indicate that he's going to rule against the state of Wyoming. If he granted that on behalf of the 14,
right,
he would be ruling against the defendants, the state. See, the plaintiffs were the ones asking for the restraining order.
Right.
And that would be to prohibit the state from pursuing any further their dismissal from the football team. They wanted to be restored. See, that's what they're asking. They were asking for affirmative relief to restore them to the football team.
Well, couldn't the restraining order just simply be, in effect, a restraining order until things could get sorted out? Or is that an indication in the law profession that he's changed his mind?
No, unless the plaintiffs can show probable cause that they will succeed on the merits. You don't issue the restraining order.
But didn't you and Hathaway and Carlson and everybody know that these students, some of them were sympathetic to the university, but they were willing to come to some sort of an agreement because they wanted to play pro ball and they wanted to go to school?
No, once they had retained an attorney, and Waterman was their attorney, and these locals, right, I couldn't talk to them about anything. I could never approach the 14.
Why not?
The law prohibits that. If you're in litigation, you cannot talk to parties. You have to go through their attorneys.
Okay, and your client was in opposition. Essentially, your client was the state of Wyoming.
Right.
Okay, and the university.
Yeah.
And President Carlson.
And head coach Eaton, the board of trustees, and the governor.
Did you sense on Coach Eaton's part, Judge, that maybe he would have given a little time to cool off, he would have changed his mind, or was he adamant?
No, he would never have changed his mind about his position concerning protests, so he would never have changed. Years later, he said the very same thing. He said he would never have changed his mind.
Even though this really did damage to his career and the state's football program?
He felt that although he realized that his rule was overbroad, he recognized that. Still, when he applied it to the football field, he had no misgivings of any kind. Never permit football players to ever use a football field in a protest of any kind, really. That would be his position.
Well, you agreed with him because you said in your article, you said, I recall that in my closing remarks to the appellate panel, I said, when and if the time should come that it is permissible to protest or criticize any religion or any religious beliefs on the playing field, that will be the time to terminate all NCAA events.
That's right.
So again, it was a freedom of speech versus a freedom of religion.
Right. Well, I don't know how many Mormon people, citizens of this state, residents of Wyoming, go to football games. I don't know how many Catholics go. I don't know how many Congregationalists or Baptists. But they certainly don't go there to find football players protesting their religion. And those players were agents of the state of Wyoming, according to the WAC rules. The university is an agent of the state of Wyoming, so that would have been my position on it.
Your interpretation of the Constitution is that even though freedom of speech, Congress shall not, the Establishment Clause and the freedom of speech issue are both in that part of the, they're in this part of the Constitution.
That's right.
Article.
That's right.
Article 1, is it?
That's correct.
Okay. So why would freedom of religion trump freedom of speech?
Well, because the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals on appeal held that even Tinker recognizes that it's paramount to prohibit anybody from using the state's facilities for that purpose.
Oh, did that come up in the Tinker decision?
the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, I quote them in my article, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, I quote the 10th Circuit and they...
Oh, here, let me give you this. This article is what you're looking
yeah,
for.
Yeah, I'll show you where I quote the 10th Circuit on appeal. It's right over here in the last page. Right there, that's from the 10th Circuit opinion on appeal.
So it says in the last page, page 7 of your Annals of Wyoming Summer 1996 article, the final chapter in the litigation was written by the United States Court of Appeals 10th Circuit when it affirmed the district court in Williams versus Eaton. The court held that the district court's findings of fact were not clearly erroneous, and on the legal issue involving the First Amendment, the court ruled, quote, we are persuaded that the trustee's decision was lawful within the limitations of the Tinker case itself. Their decision protected against invasion of the rights of others by avoiding a hostile expression to them by some members of the university team. It was in furtherance of the policy of religious neutrality by the state. It denied only the request for the armband display by some members of the team on the field and during the game. In those limited circumstances, we conclude that the trustee's decision was in conformity with the Tinker case and did not violate the First Amendment right of expression of the plaintiffs. Right of expression, yeah. We do not base our holding on the presence of any violence or disruption. Instead, the trial court referred only to the mandate of complete neutrality in religion and religious matters as the basis for the court's ruling. I see what you're saying. I see what the court is saying on this, and this is what the court decided, and I understand this is how you feel about it.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering if there is any precedent for freedom of religion to trump freedom of speech. I mean, has that come up very often?
No. You won't find that. It's pretty rare, I'm sure of that.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Pretty rare.
Okay, well, who made the decision ultimately to essentially fire the Black 14 since they were employees?
The Board of Trustees.
Okay, but did Hathaway have any influence in that? Did
Hathaway was he was ex officio chairman of the board, and he was present. Yes, he did have a part in it. He didn't have a vote, but he was the key to it, really. The reason why the court didn't talk about Eaton's rights is because by appealing to the president of the university and the board of trustees, they were bound by what their decision was, because it was the ultimate decision-making power was in the board of trustees. So it was the court looked solely to what the board of trustees were relying upon.
Who was the head of the board of trustees?
C.E. Jerry Holland.
Jerry Holland.
Uh-huh.
He passed away, didn't he?
He did about a year and a half ago.
Were you and he in agreement?
Oh, yes.
Pretty much?
I don't think Jerry didn't understand the nuances about First Amendment, this and that, but he understood the position, but he didn't.
Well, I get the impression that, and you know, I know this man's gone now, and I don't want to defame him, but I get the impression that the weak sister in all of this was President Carlson.
He wasn't very sure of himself. There's no doubt about that.
So it was really Hathaway who probably made the decision, and the board agreed because they were had a tendency to agree. Or, I mean, I'm looking for the strong person in this whole.
Well, I would say that Al Pence, Eve Johnson, Bill Jones, and Stan Hathaway, those four stand out as being the most dominant, and they were all concentrating on the religious aspect of this thing.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you this question, and I don't want you to be offended by it, but do you think that in your heart of hearts, Judge, that football was so important in this state,
mm-hmm.
such an important thing to the people of the state, and Eaton was held in such high esteem by the people of this state, that there was no way that Hathaway and the board could go against their coach?
No, I don't think that's true at all.
Really?
No. I think they had their minds were very clear when they met. As a matter of fact, I think the inclination was to try to settle the thing and get it behind them. No, and as a matter of fact, they met first with the coach and his staff and the athletic director. They wanted to talk to him a little further. By then, he had taken the football team to a movie, which they do apparently in four games. And he was resentful that they came to the theater to try to get him to leave, and he didn't leave.
Couldn't the president have said, now who asked him to leave?
I don't recall who went there and asked him to, but...
Well, let's say it was, well, we don't, let's say it was
probably
anybody.
Probably somebody from the Board of Trustees.
Right. Wouldn't that board member, I mean, if he had integrity, wouldn't he say, look, you can't tell the president of the university what you're going to do or not going to do. You must come to this meeting.
Mm-hmm. Well, he'd already been there for over an hour and so, but he wasn't told the purpose of it, unfortunately. But it wouldn't have worked, as it turned out. When Hathaway and Carlson went into that adjoining room, and Stan Hathaway pointed this out to me, Stan Hathaway made it very clear to them that they could not permit them to protest on the field because of the religious aspect of the thing. He made it very clear that that's, and that if they would forego that, everything would be all right. No protest during the game against BYU.
What if some students, and I'm just posing this conjecturally, mm-hmm. what if some students who weren't members of the football team decided that they wanted to wear black armbands and go into the crowd and carry banners and watch the football game?
Well, they could do that. They weren't representatives of the state of Wyoming. You see, the players were agents of the state of Wyoming. The WAC rules and regulations point that out very clearly. If you're on scholarship for the university, you represent that university. The university is an arm of the state of Wyoming, so there's no doubt that they were agents of the state of Wyoming. Now, had they not been, they could do whatever they please.
But ultimately, would you say as a judge, with all your experience, that for some reason that athletes are excepted from the general population when it comes to their right to protest?
Yes, anywhere except the football field in this case. Had they wanted to wear the armbands all over the campus or wherever, they could do that. His rule was far too encompassing.
And so, that's where you would have liked to have seen a more lenient rule, right?
Oh, yes. Well, as a matter of fact, the Board of Trustees recognized that when they told them they could continue their scholarships even after they were discharged. If they wanted to complete their education at the university, they'd get scholarships.
Okay.
They told them that, too.
Now, there was a comment made by more than one person in the things that I've read that said that outside agitators were responsible for this. Do you believe that?
Well, Willie Black, who was the head of the state, the Black Student Alliance, some people from Denver had come in to talk to him before this all happened. And he wrote that letter making the demand and hand-delivered it to Coach Eaton. So some of the people from Denver had met with him. I don't know who they were, but that's what they fed him, this information about the Mormon Church.
Was that the basis for calling out the National Guard?
No, I think a worry about some fisticuffs and stuff like that.
Okay.
They were very worried about whether there'd be an outbreak of fighting or so on.
You know, your point of view on this is really intriguing because you were on the inside of a lot of the negotiations, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you feel about the reaction of the Faculty Senate and the Student Senate? They both said that the students needed to be reinstated and that this basically they were opposed to what the Board of Trustees decided.
I don't think they studied the issue very clearly. That's my opinion. I would find it very difficult to have anybody make a serious contention that it's agreeable to have agents of the state of Wyoming protest against somebody's religion or religious beliefs or some church.
Even if that religion was discriminatory?
Even if they felt that it was discriminatory, correct.
Well, of course it was, right, because they didn't allow blacks into the priesthood.
Well, it's all according to how you deem this thing. See, if it's discriminatory under the Civil Rights Act, you'd be entitled to damages. And they sought damages. They sought punitive and actual damages of over $1 million. So, no, they certainly weren't entitled to any money as far as I'm concerned. And it would be difficult for me to understand why anybody would take exception to the fact that you can't permit that sort of thing to happen on the football field. And I'm talking about the confines, just as the Tenth Circuit did. We're confining the facts entirely to that point. I'm not talking about them wearing the armbands around the campus, in the field house, or wherever. As a matter of fact, they could do that. Eaton couldn't do a thing about it.
But as representatives of the state of Wyoming, as football players, if they wore the armband in the student union, for example, they'd still be representing the state in a way in which the state maybe didn't want them to be involved.
It wouldn't make any difference because the atmosphere there is entirely different. People that attend the football game are captives to what's happening out on that football field. In the student union, nobody's a captive. They're all free to come and go and do whatever they wish. And the 14 could go all over the campus, for far as I'm concerned, classrooms or whatever, if they wanted to make their point.
And I'm just questioning this because this is coming to my mind. So there's a big difference between wearing an armband when the code that the coach has created says you shan't or you cannot protest, you can't do any kind of a protest. There's a big difference between that and then carrying picket signs and wearing black armbands and marching through as a group, if the Black 14 did it, through the student union.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they, Judge, still be protesting the essential problem of the church?
Oh, yes, no doubt about that. But
as agents of the state?
No, they're agents of the state only in relationship to the football part of it. That's the WAC rule. The scholarships were for football, you see. So the agency there is on the football team. It isn't anything else. It isn't whether they're students at the university.
Okay. So it's okay to protest as a student, but it's not okay to protest as a football player.
Right. Not to wear the armbands on the football field, knowing that the purpose of that is to protest against the Mormon church.
One of the ladies that was walking around the field house the day that Eaton met with the students said that it wasn't a very polite conversation he was having with them. Now, according to some reports, Eaton went in there and listened to their arguments and then responded. And there's other people who say, like on the Black 14, they say, no, he went in there and read us the Riot Act and said that we were going to go back on Negro welfare or, you know.
Yeah, I know they did.
I mean, so what's the story? What's the true story?
Well, I don't know. I talked to Eaton, and Eaton said that one of the players, I can't remember his name right now, spoke up and said that he was studying to become a member of the Mormon Church. And Eaton's response to that was something to the effect, isn't that something? You intend to join that church and abide that faith the rest of your life, but you want to protest against it on Saturday. So I think he was, I think that they agitated Eaton. They knew they were doing it too. And he wasn't used to having somebody confront him, football players confront him in that manner.
Did you know him?
Oh, yes. I didn't know him very, very well. But I had talked to him before, but I didn't know him very well.
Well, if there's blame to hand out on both sides of the issue, would you say that maybe Eaton's problem was that he was too peremptory, he was too pugnacious in this, and he should have maybe had a little more patience?
It could be. As far as the meeting out there in the field house, I wish that things had been handled a little different, including from their point of view, too. They shouldn't have been so abrupt with the guy. They knew him. They knew he was a strict disciplinarian. They could have handled that a little different than they did. Joe Williams, in particular, knew that.
Well, I think he must have been under pressure, though, Judge, because he went to Eaton in the first place, and Eaton said, no deal, you're not going to protest.
That's right.
My interpretation of all this is that Eaton goes back to his teammates and says, we can't do this. And they said, like hell we can't. We're going to do it. I mean, that would be my impression. Because they came back and immediately Eaton reacted to it.
That's right.
So Joe Williams could have been a peacemaker, but it didn't turn out that way.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And there were other members of the 14 that could have been more diplomatic, too. They weren't either.
What was Willie Black's role in this whole thing?
He was the instigator. He fed them the information and got them riled up about this. You know, only one of them had any connection with the Mormon Church, apparently. The others weren't affected by the Mormon Church in any way except by the beliefs. But if you go by that, you know, practically every religion in the world would be able to protest something. Catholics could protest the beliefs of Baptists or Episcopalians, this and that, you know. Like,
they do. They just don't make
it. And on.
They do. They just don't make it public.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, in the late 60s, in 69, that the whole, I mean, if I could draw an analogy and say the cloud of civil rights that passed over the country just sort of whiffed right over Memorial Stadium, and I don't think that most people were in sympathy with the problems that were going on in other parts of the country and the problems that, that blacks were having.
No.
I mean, am I right, or am I just presupposing something I shouldn't be?
Probably right, because we didn't have that problem in Wyoming. We weren't aware of it anyway.
Do you think that's because we just didn't have very many blacks?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Okay.
I think that's true.
Okay.
I was sympathetic with the players in the sense that I don't think they understood the position of the state. Had they spent more time trying to explain that to them, it might have made a difference. But I don't. According to Stan Hathaway, he doesn't think that's true. He said he asked them whether they would return to the football team after the game. They said no. Then, in particular, when he asked if they would return with respect to firing Coach Eaton, nobody spoke up and said no. They weren't requiring that. They all were ordering that he be fired.
Probably, maybe because they felt they had to stick together at that point.
I think so, but they were just as arbitrary there as he was, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How has this whole thing affected your life?
Well, I was so much involved in the litigation part of it, that strictly the legal issue, you know, itself. But aside from that, I was sympathetic with the 14 because I know that they weren't properly informed of the position of the state. I asked Joe Williams whether he had been notified of the state's position in the lawsuit. He said no. The lawyers hadn't told them anything about the state's position. Not a word. As far as I'm concerned, that's pretty bad business, when they didn't have the foggiest idea what the position of the state was.
Was Waterman kind of a dictator among these people, or did Graves have anything to say about it, or Reeves or Smythe or any of those guys?
If they did have, they didn't let me know about it. Waterman's the only one that spoke up during the meeting in my office. He relied exclusively on Tigger versus Des Moines. He was just cocky as could be about that. Didn't give the foggiest idea about the prohibition, about the Establishment Clause, you know.
He impressed you as a person who maybe was bogged down with his own importance, is that it?
And he was going to make history of another civil rights case. He was using these 14 to make hay. That's what he was doing.
Was there a lot of racial tension at the time? Not prejudice necessarily, but was there tension? Was there any kind of racial tension? Did you feel that?
No, I didn't think so. Eaton certainly didn't think so. And Waterman said to me in the office, see, that complaint doesn't charge racial discrimination in any way, shape, or form. It's just First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say that they were discriminated because of their race. He said to me in the office, there isn't a discriminatory bone in Lloyd Eaton's body.
That's Waterman said that?
You bet he did. And he'd spent 10 days over there on the campus. But that's what he said. There isn't a discriminatory bone in Lloyd Eaton's body.
Was Waterman white or black?
He was black.
Okay. Out of Detroit, right?
Pontiac, Michigan, yeah.
Pontiac. What would make him say that?
Well, he spent a lot of time over there, and he just volunteered it because there wasn't, as I said, there isn't a single complaint about racial discrimination.
Well, if he said that Eaton didn't have a discriminatory bone in his body, then he must have felt that they could have come to some resolution of the problem.
Of course he knew they could, but he didn't want to.
Did he say anything to give you an indication that he had an agenda?
Yeah, he did when he came back, when I went up to say hello to him just before the hearing started. He didn't mention the meetings of any kind. I waited a little bit, and then I finally went over and said to him, what is the decision concerning the meeting? There'll be no such meetings. That was it, period. That was the end of the conversation as far as he's concerned.
Was Judge Kerr involved at an early date, or do you think he was aware of all this that was going on?
No, he wasn't aware of that at the time. I went in and told his secretary that they had refused the meetings, so we're going to go ahead with the hearing. And I asked an assistant I had to go in and call Eaton. Eaton was right by his telephone over at the athletic department, had all of his staff there, all of the football coaches, Paul Roach and Fritz Schirmer, all of them, ready to get in the cars and come to Cheyenne. My assistant told me that he was very disappointed.
This is Kerr's assistant? Assistant.
My assistant, yeah.
Who was it?
Jack Spate.
Oh, Spate, okay.
Yeah.
So he said that who was disappointed?
That Eaton was very disappointed.
Eaton was disappointed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How'd you get along with Judge Kerr?
Oh, I got along fine with him.
Was he a mentor to you, or?
Oh, I guess in a way, yes, he was. Uh-huh.
Because I think, like, the preceding judges in that position, he was head of the Republican Party, wasn't he?
He was for some years, uh-huh. He sure was, yeah.
I think you've given us a lot here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, just like the Tenth Circuit said there, I always confined it exclusively to the facts.
To the issue.
Just the issues. When Lloyd Eaton did away with his rule, I remember meeting with him, and I said, you have to do that. You can't restrain them from wearing armbands around the campus or at meetings or whatever. He didn't like it, but he recognized that he had to do that.
And he changed it.
But, you know, he received support from people like coaches Woody Hayes and Bear Bryant. Why? Because they're strict disciplinarians.
Do you think times have changed?
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
I mean, he'd never be allowed to get away with this today, right?
Well, you mean the same set of facts?
Right.
Oh, I think on the same set of facts that he would get away with it. You mean whether...
Well, I'm just saying that the societal attitudes have changed now. And,
oh, yeah.
And a coach could not get away with being
a strict disciplinarian
as easily as he could have, say, in the late 60s.
Probably not, although I'm not that acquainted with what goes on today with football teams. I think most coaches are disciplinarians. I think they just by nature, that's what they are. Eaton was every bit that.
Do you think that the football team would have gone on and done great things forever and ever? I think you mentioned something like that in your article.
Yeah, they would have. Things would have been. I don't know how long Eaton would have stayed as coach, but he was relatively young. He had a great staff. Boy, what a great staff he had.
And he had some great athletes, too.
Yeah, and that staff was able to recruit those kind of players.
Mm-hmm.
So that was no accident. So think that little old Wyoming was able to get those kind of players to come to, athletes, to come to Wyoming. Really, it's kind of amazing when you stop and think about it.
Yeah.
He had far less money than any of these other big-time schools. He didn't have any money to work with at all, you know. And the fact that the 14 went on with their education shows they were not ignorant people. They sat in the jury box during the hearing that we had, and I'd look up and look at the 14 of them. I think, my God, what a box full of manhood here, you know.
You mean these guys were good physical specimens?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and how could any football team survive without that kind of material, you know? The fact that they were so adamant about, all of them made a point they wanted to play on the field because the pro scouts were grading them, you know. Joe Williams had three different outfits looking at him.
Three different pro teams?
Yeah. Had they accepted that meeting with Eaton and Judge Kerr, there still were four games left. So they would have had four more games to display their wares before those pro scouts. And that's what they wanted to do. So had Waterman informed them of the prospects of the meeting, they would have accepted it. I'm sure that every one of them, well, except one, when I talked to him on the telephone, just one player said he would not have attended the meeting. Just
Ooh.
One player.
You remember who that was?
A fellow by the name of, I think his name, he was from Denver. I can't think.
Oh, Don Meadows?
No, Meadows came back to the team. He and...
See, Hysaw, Willie Hysaw?
It could have been Hysaw.
So you talked to all these guys?
I did this long after the cases.
Really?
It just festered me so badly to think that Waterman didn't inform them of the possibility of the meeting, that I wanted to find out for my own personal purposes whether or not he had notified them. So I got the telephone numbers of all of them from the athletic department, and I called them. And with the exception of one player, they all said they didn't know about the meeting. They weren't told by Waterman or anybody else about the meeting. Had they been told, they would have attended the meeting.
Now, the meeting we're talking about, just for the record, is which meeting?
The one between Judge Kerr sitting in and Coach Eaton and an assistant.
Okay.
With the individual player.
Okay, so was it Kerr that was trying to get everybody together?
Judge Kerr would have sat in on the meetings.
Who was the one that was trying to get them together one last time, though?
Well, I suggested the meeting, and Judge Kerr said, will you find out if Coach Eaton was willing to do that? So I went in the side room and called and talked to him. Not only was he willing, he was anxious, and he was looking forward to it. He said he would get his entire staff and have them right there by the telephone. He said, what time will the meetings be? And I said, well, I don't know yet, because Mr. Waterman has to approve it. So he was right there at his office with his staff when Jack Spaight called. They were all there, ready to come to Cheyenne. And so...
And Jack told him what?
When Jack had to tell him that...
There will be no meeting.
There will be no such meeting, yeah.
He's relaying Waterman's instructions.
Yeah.
And every one of the Black 14, except for this one, would have come to the meeting?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every single one would have come.
How does that make you feel?
Makes me feel... I was mad. I was mad about it because I think that a lot of these civil rights cases are drummed up. I think that they go out of their way to find the avenue for these cases. And that's what Waterman was doing with the University of Wyoming. He was going to make racial discrimination civil rights history against the University of Wyoming. That was his only purpose in this thing. He had no more care for the 14 as the man in the moon.
Well, apart from this case, and do you feel like the blacks in the state at this time and at the university had legitimate gripes?
Legitimate gripes?
About, not only about the church, but about the fact that they were, well, for example, Lloyd Eaton told Mel Hamilton that he shouldn't get married to a white girl. I mean, those kind of things.
Oh, I don't approve of those kind of things. No, I don't.
So you recognize that there were problems that they had to endure.
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm sure they do.
I didn't think you were ignorant.
Oh, no, I'm sure of that, yeah. No, I was sympathetic with their plight. I know they have a tough road to hoe, and it isn't easy being over here at the University of Wyoming with so few fellow blacks. So I admire the people that are the players who stick with the program and make the best of it they can, get their education. No, I have no problem with blacks as such. I was in sympathy with the 14, as a matter of fact, as far as I thought they were pretty innocent people. They didn't understand the complexities of this thing. Nobody spent any time telling them anything either, and I felt badly about that. I would like to have been able to talk to them, but of course I couldn't do it.
Well, your words are important because I think that this is an important event in Wyoming history.
Mr. Graves, on a television program, made the remark that they tried several times to settle this case, is what he said. That is an absolute falsehood. They never at one time ever contacted me about settlement. Never. The only time I had any contact with them was at one meeting when Waterman laid the rules down about what we had to do. Not a single time did they offer to meet any settlement of any kind. Never did.
At the time, can you remember how you viewed your position as a go-between, a mediator?
If it hadn't been for the lawsuit, I'd have been maybe in a position to do that, but they didn't give me that opportunity.
Well, Judge, this has been very valuable, and I know you've spent almost 3 hours of your life talking about this.
That's all right, Mark. I appreciate having the opportunity.
This podcast was produced by the Wyoming State Archives by Sue Castaneda. The interviewer was Wyoming historian Mark Youngie. It was funded by the Wyoming Cultural Trust Fund. Be sure to listen to all of the other Wyoming stories on yoarchives.org.